Hey, how you guys doing? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Express. Later on the show, Jason Leopold is going to be here to talk about his recent FOIA claims against the U.S. on Guantanamo issues. Bet that sounds terrible in your ear, doesn't it? And not the Leopold thing, the mess with the mic thing. And yeah, so Leopold, he's going to have some things to teach us about Obama's Caribbean gulag down there in communist Cuba, fittingly, later on here, just a little while. And then also Alan Butler is going to be joining us, and I got a few other invites out, but Robert Butler's going to be here also to talk about the new jobs numbers and this kind of thing. So I really screwed up. I had an appointment, a radio interview scheduled today. But see, I don't ever schedule interviews weeks in advance. So the one time I scheduled an interview weeks in advance, I completely spaced out. I mean, I remembered a few different times, but not near enough to the show. So, now I feel bad standing somebody up for the show, but I'm just in no position to do the interview, because I don't know what the hell. So, yeah, sometimes I'm bad at this. Sometimes there are silver linings to bad things, though. Check this out. There's a person who I assume must be a wonderful lady named Taryn, who lives down there in Australia and is a fan of the show. And some horrible thing happened. I have no idea what that horrible thing might have been. Can't imagine. But some horrible thing happened, and Taryn lost her hearing. Fan of the show. Well, how's she supposed to hear the show if she can't hear anything? Well, it turns out, from what I hear, with my ears that thankfully still work for now, she's going to get better, they assume, and she'll get her hearing back. But at least in the meantime, I've picked up a transcriptionist. Now, I'll tell you about transcriptionists. A lot of people think that they can transcribe things well, but very few people actually can transcribe things well. This is my experience. If I had to, you know, rate the proportions, I would say out of a couple of handfuls of volunteer transcribers that have done some work here and there over the years for the show, there's really only been two or three of them who really were good at it that I could, you know, where I didn't even really have to go back over and read over it to know what's going on in there and know that I could trust it to post it. And apparently that's happened again. Because Taryn's friend, Joanne, who has been, talk about a good friend, she's been transcribing my show. Wow, Taryn must really like this show. Joanne has been transcribing not just the interviews, but the whole damn show. So that her newly deaf friend, Taryn, has something to read and get angry about. And so, hey, turns out she's got a surplus of transcripts of the show. So, if you go and check out scotthorton.org/interviews right now, you'll find that we've got interviews for the last half dozen, transcripts for the last half dozen interviews up there already. Isn't that great? I don't know how long, we can keep this thing going, but sure sounds good to me. I'm loving it. Like fast food. So, yeah. Good times there. And so very soon that will include a great interview, presumably a great interview with Jason Leopold. He's always good. Me, you know, it's a hit or miss. But Jason is going to be great on Guantanamo issues coming up. Hunger strike and torture and, yeah, communist Cuba. But so there's the silver lining to Taryn's terrible misfortune, which... you know, I'm not saying I'm happy about it or whatever, but I'm just saying the silver lining is we're going to have some transcripts for the interviews, at least for now. Isn't that great? And I wonder how long before Joanne's fingers get tired, because typically we do 2 or 3 interviews a day here. Well, that's supposed to be the standard anyway. That's a lot of typing, 2 hours worth of transcript every day. Even if she was doing just the interviews, that's a lot of typing. But I don't know. I'm really happy with the ones that she sent in already, so I'm pretty stoked about that. Again, scotthorton.org/interviews if you want the interviews, and now including the transcripts. Isn't that cool? And please feel better soon. Even if I never get another transcript again, I sure hope that Taryn gets her hearing back immediately, if possible. If anybody knows any magic words or any kind of cool stuff that you could do to help, then let me know and I'll try to let her know. Through our new mutual friend, Joanna. All right. So, guess what? Yats is in D.C. Scott Horton, who's Yats? Oh, this is Yats. Here's Yats.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawny Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them 4 times a week.
Uh-huh. So, Yats, he's America's pick for regime change in Ukraine. That's Victoria Nuland back before the coup, talking about how, yeah, we want Yats. And Tawny Book, he's the guy with the Hitler salute from the Svoboda Party. Formerly the Social Nationalists. Isn't that hilarious? Oh, we're not National Socialists. We're Social Nationalists. Oh, okay, good. Yeah, they're worship as heroes, those who fought for the Nazis in the Second World War. But, you know, whatever. They're a bunch of great guys. Because they were picked by America, and that's what makes them great. Hey, if the Americans can hire dozens and dozens and who knows how many actual Nazis after World War II, certainly they can hire a bunch of wannabe Nazis now over there in Ukraine. If, you know, if they need some brown shirt stormtroopers to help them overthrow a government and install Yats in power. Well, Yats, he's in Washington, D.C. meeting with High Commander Obama about the future of Ukraine. And what's kind of funny is, I'm assuming, maybe, kinda, without knowing, that Obama is telling Yats, I can't do nothing for you, man. Did the Americans promise they would have your back? Oh yeah, no, they didn't mean that. It's always a toss-up, right, whether it's more dangerous to be ignored by America, to be the enemies of America, or to be the friends of America. Because our empire's going to screw you one way or the other. I think it was Henry Kissinger, right, who said, hey, at least if you're our enemy, you know where we stand. If you're our friend, look out, because we're about to stab you in the back. When there a quote, somebody in the chat room, Fitzy G, help me out. Didn't Kissinger say something like that? You better look out if you're a friend of mine. I might murder you. I think that was the, you know, rough paraphrase. ScottHorton.org/chat, by the way, if you want to hang out with the geniuses in there. But yeah, no, I can swear there's a Henry Kissinger quote like that about how dangerous it is to be one of America's friends. And in this case, you know, there was a thing, the former blogger Bill Mann, now Twitterer Bill Mann, actually had a kind of 4-step program to how the Americans screw the Ukrainians by encouraging them to freeze out the Russians in such a way as to provoke this terrible backlash, and then answer the only true answer. At the end of the day, they really are realists, aren't they? We can't do anything for you. Why murder 1 million Iraqis? Doable. That was Paul Wolfowitz's answer. It's doable. Getting into a war with Russia over Ukraine, why, that's not doable at all. Even for an ideologue like Paul Wolfowitz, right? Even for an ideologue like anybody. So, anyway, Yats is in D.C., and I don't know what Obama's telling him. Have mercy, I hope he's not making any big promises, any more big promises, but, yeah. All right, so I'm about out of time for this segment. We're about to go out to break. But when we get back, I've got more on Ukraine. I'm going to try to be brief because I've got a bunch of different points to make, and I'm not going to make any of them well. I'm just going to make a lot of them. I hope that'll be useful for you. And then we've also got Iran news. We've got, I want to talk about Republicans and how much I don't like them. And then there's new Snowden, brand new Snowden in the New York Times and over at The Intercept as well. Big stuff. Big breaking Snowden Doc stories. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and I guess first thing I want to mention here about Ukraine is I want to point you again toward antiwar.com and Ted Snyder's article. You might have to search. I don't think you can find his archives from the front page there. He's just written a few for them so far. But anyway, it's 21st Century Coups, Ukraine and 21st Century Coups by Ted Snyder at antiwar.com, where he goes through and does a real good job of making the case for American intervention here and the way that they laid the groundwork for the regime change in Ukraine, including down to the Machiavellian plot, seemingly Machiavellian plot to, you know, while they're pretending they're trying so hard to get Yanukovych to sign the deal with the West, they were really offering him a deal that he could not accept and maintain power and authority inside Ukraine. They really preferred at that point to not to have a regime change and a new deal with the new parties in power rather than make a deal with the old guy that they didn't like. Apparently, and help lead to that regime change. And, of course, the other thing is that, and this is really the bottom line, sanctions. Sanctions. What does that mean? In this context, it means a direct threat from the Americans and the Europeans that they would seize the bank accounts of all the Ukrainian oligarchs. So any billionaire welfare parasite in Ukraine, who has a bank account anywhere in the world but Ukraine, which guarantee they keep their wealth out of the country, that they would have to give it all up. That the U.S. state, the 9-zillion-ton gorilla, will get what it wants, and it will seize all of your bank accounts if you don't get rid of this guy. And that was what really made the regime change happen. And then what these guys did, and again, I'll recommend this Ted Rall article, because he did a really great job on this, talking about how one of their first orders of business was to ban Russian as a second language. Well, Russian is really a first language for most of Ukraine. It's Ukrainian that's a second language. And maybe that's, you know, a sad legacy of the communist USSR dictatorship there and all that they did to, try to, basically do the opposite thing and marginalize Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian language. For these Ukrainian nationalists who have taken power to try to outlaw Russian even as an official second language was seen as a major assault, of course, on the ethnic Russians and those who identify with the Russian state, and especially in Crimea, and help to precipitate the crisis and help basically provoke the Russians into invading Crimea. And honestly, invading is a pretty loaded term in this case. Nobody's been killed. Nobody's died in the invasion of Crimea, because the Russians already have a huge military presence there. The Ukrainian military hasn't tried to fight them. I mean, they have a presence on the Crimean Peninsula as well, but they don't have a prayer in taking on the Russians. They haven't tried to. Thankfully, cooler heads have prevailed on their side as well. And it's basically already a fait accompli, as even Robert Gates said. Crimea is lost. The Russians are taking it back. You know, the Americans, it'd be like if, I don't know, you, whoever you are, played chess against me. I don't know how to play chess. I'm just going to move my horsey. I don't know. I never had the patience, right? You might think that I'm the kind of guy who would like to play chess, but I would rather go play outside. You know, I just never learned chess when I was a kid. I was too active. So if you play chess against me, I might do something stupid like push a second regime change in 10 years in Ukraine, and then you might do a thing like move your castle and take the Crimea. The Crimean Peninsula, where most of those people identify as Russian, where it was annexed, I think, in right as the American Revolution was wrapping up in 1783. What year did the American Revolution? 1781? I'm trying to remember. Anyway, 1783 is when the Russian Empire first annexed Crimea, and it belonged to them all along until Khrushchev gave it to the Ukrainians, but that was when Ukraine was in the USSR, and so it didn't make any difference, really. And so, it's no surprise. I'm not trying to justify what the Russians did, but I'm just saying it's no surprise. And, you know, if the Americans are so Machiavellian that they want to give Yanukovych an offer he can't possibly accept in order to provoke a coup, then they ought to be smart enough to recognize that, hey, Russians are people too. Ooh, the Russians, they're politicians too. And they're going to do politician-y type things like, I don't know, maybe invade and take Crimea and say what? That's what I thought. You go meddling where you don't belong, you lose the Crimea. And anyway, Ukraine is too far from here for any of this intervention. And that's what the Americans think, too. The American people, not the American politicians. From the Washington Post today, only 29% of Americans would like for the Obama administration to take a, quote, firm stand against Russia's incursion into its neighbor, which the Crimean Peninsula is not quite invading eastern Ukraine, much less all of it. But anyway, while nearly twice as many, 56% prefer the U.S. not get too involved, another 15% did not have an opinion. Isn't that funny? I don't really have an opinion about Ukraine. Well, could you please default against intervention then? 15%. Well, I don't know enough about it, but I guess I could be for intervening there. Okay, guys, thanks. 15%. I don't know. Yeah, when it comes to nuclear war over Ukraine, I don't really have an opinion. Okay, good. Fine, thanks. I guess it's better than being outright pro-war. And you know, I'm trying to find, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Friedersdorf over at The Atlantic pointed out that it's a minuscule number of Republicans, self-identified Republicans, who are willing to get into a fight over this. And it's an even smaller number of, I think he says, the number of self-identified Democrats, that is the party of the president, the number of them who are willing to support any kind of intervention or further intervention in Ukraine is barely higher than the error rate of the poll. So 4 or 5%, 6%, something like that. So, and that's absolutely regardless of what they have to say on TV about it. That's regardless of the consensus on TV about how outraged we are all supposed to feel. So, even with this ridiculous 15% that's not willing to default against intervention, and that's a pretty high number of don't knows, don't you think? Even with them, the vast majority. I mean, think about that. Take 15% out of the equation because they had no answer. And it was still almost 60% said they were against taking any kind of stand over Ukraine at all. Especially, we're talking about war with the Russians. If it came down to it, a firm stand means or else something, right? And they got H-bombs. Thousands and thousands of H-bombs. So, who wants to have a conflict with them? Not the American people. Seems kind of relevant to me. And now, man, I'm almost out of time. I always go on dang too long. But yes, there are Nazi groups involved. The Svoboda group as well as Right Sector. And if you go and look at Justin Romano's column today at antiwar.com/Justin, he talks a little bit about this. Oh, and he links back to his last piece where he goes out and he names 8 members of these radical right-wing nationalist factions who are now members of the government, including the head of the new internal security forces and whatever exactly they call them, the secret police, whatever, are now run by these right-wing neo-fascist thugs. And it's hilarious. I keep getting these emails and people on my Facebook page saying, oh, yeah, well, here's a Jewish guy in Ukraine who's not a Nazi. So there. Yeah, so what? What does that mean? So I guess there are no Nazis in Alabama either because I know a guy in Alabama who's not a Nazi. Isn't that brilliant? What a brilliant argument, say the apologists for the American Empire who have hired Nazi brown shirt stormtroopers to help them seize and topple a government. Not all of them are Nazis, and that proves that none of them are Nazis. Wow, you're really smart. I'm completely convinced by your wonderful argument. Except that somebody drew big SS lightning bolts on that placard, and somebody was hanging up the Iron Cross inside the city hall. And here's a high-quality JPEG of the head of Svoboda, who you can hear, again, here's what's-her-name talking about him.
What he needs is Cleach and Tawny Book on the outside.
Tawny Book with his Hitler salute in the air, who Victoria Nuland has hired for his job as part of the new coalition. And then one last thing, I guess, before we go out to break here. Oh, no, sorry, I still got 1 minute. Well, two things. First of all, Beinart wrote a great thing in The Atlantic that I thought was important. Maybe I lost the damn thing. I lost my tabs, got all mixed up. But Beinart wrote this thing in The Atlantic last week where he talked about the extent of NATO expansion and even including these military working groups with the stands, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and Turkmenistan and Kyrgyzstan, that all these countries have pseudo working alliances with NATO. It's the extent of the Cold War that America has continued to wage against the Russians over the last 25 years has gone mostly unnoticed. But Beinart does a really good job of making you look at it from the Russians' point of view for just a second about just how encircled they are by the United States. And then I also have to complain about Rand Paul. If you go and look at what he wrote for Time magazine, despite all his BS posturing and whatever, the where the rubber meets the road is, he's for sanctions, and he's for putting the anti-ballistic missiles into Poland. The decision that Obama had changed his mind and stopped. Rand wants to go ahead and provoke the Russians with that. Can you believe that? Look the other way. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right of the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, you know, I used to be concerned about this hunger strike down at Guantanamo Bay. And a bunch of people who, most of them were kidnapped and sold for bounties by the Pakistani military to the U.S. Army back in 2001 and 2002. Never charged with a crime, no evidence against them, held forever without trial. And here they are trying to starve themselves to death. The only way they can commit suicide. But now I've come to understand that's not really a problem anymore because they've called off their hunger strikes. They're no longer trying to starve themselves to death. Now they're just on long-term non-religious fasts, which sounds to me like it probably doesn't hurt too bad. Isn't that right? Jason Leopold's on the line. He's now writing for Vice.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Great to be with you.
Yeah, a long-term non-religious fast, huh?
Long-term non-religious fast. The mangling of phrases and words and introduction of new euphemisms at Guantanamo continues.
That's my favorite part of 1984, honestly. I mean, even when I was in high school and I first read it, that was my favorite part, was when Winston's neighbor or his co-worker at the Ministry of Truth, I guess, I think he sees him in the cafeteria, and the guy's like, hey, check it out, man. We got the 11th edition of the Newspeak Dictionary. It's got fewer words than ever before. We're really narrowing everything down and beating the life out of all terminology in the world.
Well, you have to wonder if that's what they're thinking. I mean, you know, this follows the use of phrases such as humane restraints, which is what they call, the shackles. And they actually say that to us when we're down there. When we say restraints, they will say, I mean, when we say shackles, they'll say, oh, you mean the humane restraints. We're corrected when we talk about Guantanamo as being a prison. They say there is no prison here. It's a detention facility. And they're very, very serious about it. But I have to tell you, Scott, this is just amazing because, I mean, in previous standard operating procedures, and that's what this is. This is a standard operating procedure that the medical personnel at Guantanamo uses with the prisoners, who, by the way, we're also told we can't refer to them as prisoners; they're detainees. This is what they use to manage the hunger strikers. But the fact that they literally stripped out any reference to hunger strike is just stunning. In fact, the title of the SOP previously had the term hunger strike in it. This has been renamed Medical Management of Detainees with Weight Loss.
Oh, man. Isn't that
great? That's what they call this.
Orwell must have been thinking of the U.S. military above and beyond when he was writing about the Newspeak. I mean, they really are the masters of this kind of jargon on all levels. That's even the George Carlin skit, right? Was like, these guys measure nuclear radiation in something they call sunshine units.
They're at war
with the truth more than anything else.
Well, they're really... They really do not want this to be seen as, you know, anything other than it's weight loss. It has nothing to do with a political protest, the medical personnel should not even think about, this in terms of, the politics or their detention, that it's just, they're losing weight, and this is what your job is. And, it's
like they're animals in a zoo.
Exactly.
Take all the humanity out of it. It's not a medical condition or a crisis of a human being. It's just a waste that needs thickening.
Exactly. It's, certainly, you know, strips out the, you know, any sort of, I guess if it were to come up, if it were to conjure up any images or feelings or emotions with regard to, you know, these are prisoners, these are my words now, you know, prisoners that are, you know, protesting their indefinite detention, and there's just, there's nothing there. You know, keep in mind that this is a document that was, by the way, I obtained this document through a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. I have I currently have 7 Freedom of Information Act lawsuits against the government, Scott. This one pertains to a lawsuit against the Department of Defense, in which I'm seeking more than 100, or rather, I have 100 different FOIAs that they, you know, failed to comply with. So this is, you know, one document that was released, and so it wasn't for public consumption previously. This was just an internal document. So just the fact that even on the internal, you know, just internally that they don't want to think about this way, that's what's even amazing. It's not just that they're telling us in the media or telling the public that they're not even referring to it as a hunger strike. They're even inside, for the folks that are there every day, they are, you know, they're in a fog. They're in a completely whole different world where this
doesn't
exist.
Well, and Orwell would say it's for them especially, right?
What's that?
Orwell would say all the propaganda is for them especially,
yeah,
more than anyone else, right?
And
us proles are allowed to think what we want because we can't do anything about it. But the people who are implementing this stuff, they have to believe or they won't do their job right.
Exactly. And I think that's what makes this such a great example of, you know, the newspeak and you know, and everything that you're raising here with regard to, you know, with regard to Orwell and how Orwellian this all is, because this is literally their own internal, you know, instructional manual and guidebook. And, you know, this is the third time, by the way, that these hunger strike protocols had been altered or changed in 2013, and I believe we spoke last year when I obtained the other version, which was in May of 2013, which was completely unredacted, by the way. That was simply, I didn't even file a FOIA for that. That actually was just given to me when I asked, and they certainly didn't make that mistake again. But, you know, that one mentioned hunger strike. It also contained information about when you're placed into the restraint chair and the mask you have to wear over your mouth. This doesn't have any of that. This just simply, you know, there's whole redacted pages. So, you know, in terms of really understanding what has changed on the physical level, like, you know, whether it's a certain number of pounds, that is hard to tell because it's not there. That's why the whole non-religious fast, you know, just stuck out. And you know, 2013 was a, you know, mass hunger strike at Guantanamo. And the timing of this particular document, you know, it's certainly interesting because they implemented this just as they were, just as they also implemented a new policy in which they would no longer provide the media with any information about the number of hunger strikers, the number of prisoners who are being force-fed, nothing. And so in the past 3 to 4 months, there's been a blackout, a media blackout at Guantanamo, where we just cannot obtain any information about the operations, about what's happening.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is the thing of it, too. I mean, all these guys, they're not really trying to starve themselves to death, right? They are, in effect, but only they're doing it in this most horrible slow-motion fashion to try to get our attention under the theory that, you know, there's any kind of democratic authority held in the hands of the people of America, that we might do the right thing and force our government to do the right thing and give them a shot before a judge, you know, something, some kind of due process or charges or something to relieve them of their condition, this purgatory that they're stuck in, this legal black hole. And yet, when it was getting through and it was such a major news story last spring, the military's decision, as you describe it, to just clamp down on the information worked. That was it. And now they're just starving themselves to death, and nobody's even taking notice anymore because they were able to just clamp down on the information. So this was starting to become a thing in the news cycle. Well, let's check in on the hunger strike down at Guantanamo, not just on this show, but on TV from time to time. And all that's over now.
Yes.
They're just dying now.
It's completely over, and... you know, I mean, keep in mind that there, you know, we just can't get that information. We don't know, you know, what's happening there because they, you know, obviously refuse to provide the information. But I was there in December.
Well, I mean, and Clive Stafford Smith has this thing about a client of his who's suing to stop his force feeding. So it's still going on with some of them, even if we don't know all of the numbers.
Yes, and they just filed a lawsuit yesterday, and that's a pretty historic lawsuit because it would actually. Possibly be the first time that a court would, you know, sort of weigh in on this and take a look at everything. But and by the way, this standard operating procedure fits, you know, very nicely with that lawsuit. You know, they also filed a version of this standard operating procedure with their, you know, with their lawsuit. But you know, the description of what he was going through, that what that particular prisoner was being subjected to. It's horrific. I mean, it's very difficult reading. But when I was there in December, Scott, the military officials basically said, the reason we are not providing you with any more information, the reason that we stopped providing you with information about the hunger strikers is because the hunger strikers were successful in attracting media attention, and we simply don't want to help them with that.
Right.
And they were very, very open and in admitting that, you know, hey, look, they got media attention, and we don't want to help them get media attention, so we're not giving you that info anymore.
Right. Because it's all about, you know, giving in to terrorists or something like that. It's not about telling the American people who have the right to know about what's happening under their, you know, the color of their authority, supposedly.
Right.
That's the last consideration in mind here.
Yeah. So... you know, and you know, just to bring up your point about the, you know, about the fact that you know, give them some due process rights. I mean, look, you know, it's we just passed 12 years. You and I will be talking about the same exact issues in the months ahead. I think that there is a certain level of fatigue that's setting in, if you can believe it. You know, on the military side, they don't want to be bothered with this anymore. They want this to simply just sort of disappear. And, you know, as I mentioned, they've been very successful at that, certainly over the past 3 or 4 months, because there hasn't been any information coming out. But when you do finally get an opportunity to obtain some info in the form of, say, a standard operating procedure like this, you really get an understanding of how little has changed.
Right.
You know, they are continuing to operate to some degree, you know, in the same way that they have been for, you know, for more than a decade.
All right, y'all. It's Jason Leopold, now writing over at Vice.com. And this one is called Guantanamo Now Calls Hunger Strikes Long-Term Non-Religious Fasts. We'll be right back after this. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jason Leopold. This one's for Vice.com, news.vice.com. Guantanamo now calls hunger strikes long-term non-religious fasts. a.k.a. attempted suicide, avoided only through torture. The torture of the force-feeding. Now, can you describe a little bit in real terms, if your six-year-old is listening, maybe change the channel back to pop music or something there. Can you explain what it really means to tie somebody down and force-feed them Ensure brand products there, Jason, down at Guantanamo?
You know, I mean, there's obviously been much discussion about what that entailed, and there have been medical professionals that said that the way that they do it at Guantanamo rises to the level of torture. And there have been, you know, other people, for example, the medical officers that I've spoken with when I went to visit Guantanamo said, oh, this is, you know, it's painless. It's not really, you know, this is no big deal. I do the same thing in hospitals. But what they're doing is that, you know, they are, for the most part, the prisoners who refuse any meals and their weight drops to a certain level and that they need to be, you know, that they need to be force-fed, or what they call, again, some newspeak here, enteral feeding, that, you know, they're taken to a restraint chair by force, you know, with shackles, with a guard force. They're put into that restraint chair, and it's a six-point restraint, so your head is restrained, your arms, your ankles, and they have a tube. You know, a tube shoved up their nose until it reaches their stomach, you know, they'll test it out with to make sure, you know, with water to make sure that it actually reached their stomach, and then through a bag, they, you know, like an intravenous type bag, they'll start pumping in that liquid Ensure, and they're doing this against their will. So. Again, that's what's so important here is that when you go to a hospital, obviously, if you have no choice, you can't eat. Okay, you know, this is what you're, you know, what's being done to you. These are people who are resisting, and so that you know, the World Medical Association said if they can make a, you know, their own choices about the refusing to eat, you have to respect it. Here, you know, they're going through what many have said is a very, very painful process because of, you know, certainly the way they're moving around, that there's been claims that the tubes are being shoved through, you know, in their nose without any lubrication, pulled out, there's blood, there's vomiting. It's the
when they
the
use like an extra thick gauge hose that they don't need to use as well, right?
I'm sorry?
Don't they use extra thick hoses that they, you know, far beyond what's required?
That's what's been said as well. I mean, you know, keep in mind that the attorneys, you know, are getting this information from the prisoners, and when we try to follow it up in the media, you know, the folks at Guantanamo say, absolutely not, that's not true. We're using the proper, you know, the proper tubes. But, you know, there's been talk that they're, you know, they're making this as painful as possible in order to stop the hunger strike, to get them to, you know, stop their long-term non-religious fast.
Yeah, accusations which are a lot more believable than a lot of the ones being leveled against these people that are the excuse for holding them there in the first place, some of whom haven't even been accused of anything.
Correct. Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean, that's
one way
so,
to measure it, you know.
that's what's just so crazy about this, Scott. I mean, you know, there's hunger strikes actually happening here in the U.S. as well. So in immigration jails recently, actually as of yesterday, there are ICE is holding, you know, a bunch of people. And so in Washington State, you have two dozen ICE detainees who are being, you know, who are just placed in medical, under medical watch because they're on hunger strike. So, you know, this whole idea is it's a protest. They are protesting their confinement. You know, up in Pelican Bay, you know, you have the hunger strikers who are protesting, their placement in solitary confinement. What stands out about Guantanamo is that when they resort to force feeding, you know, this is not like they're going to a judge, you know, and saying, hey, Your Honor, this is what we need to do, and they're considering it. This is a policy that ultimately the last word, the person who has the last word on this to sign off on it, is the commander of Joint Task Force Guantanamo. So it's not even a doctor who, you know, gets the final word. I mean, a doctor sort of, you know, weighs in on it. It's, you know, it's their policy. And so it differs dramatically from, you know, from what they say happens at the, you know, Bureau of Prisons or you know, even in, you know, with regard to immigration. But who knows what's happening there right now? I mean, you know, I can't even tell you what, you know, the number of hunger strikers there are currently. But if you read that lawsuit that was filed yesterday for, you know, one prisoner who hasn't even been accused, or rather hasn't been charged, and what he's saying and his account of what's been happening, it's horrific. I mean, they're saying that they've been pumping in the fluid so quickly that it's causing, you know, it's certainly causing him to vomit, but then causing this, you know, distension of the intestines. When you put liquid into, you know, body, particularly in that form, the way that they are, so quickly, it could also lead to pneumonia. That's one of the side effects, actually, believe it or not, from force feeding. So, and from what he's claiming, that, you know, there are steps that they're taking, that they're trying to break this hunger strike, and so they are apparently, allegedly, implementing these new procedures.
Man, you know, I don't know. Maybe I should do like Colbert and get into the satire business and just work hard on setting all these things up to trick everybody into thinking we're talking about foreign countries that we need to invade for the first half of it, you know, and then, but every time it ends up, we're talking about America at the end. Are you kidding me? This is the kind of thing where if it was any other country, it would be our government's talking point of why it's okay for us to kill them, because we're saving them from the kind of people who would do this to them. Like, even Andrew Sullivan went and found where if you translate from the original German, it literally, the SS documents translate directly to enhanced interrogation techniques. I mean,
right.
This is, we are really, and maybe this has always been the American way, some would certainly argue. But right now, I mean, we're way past the point of embracing this and allowing this to just roll on with no accountability whatsoever. No one even seems to care anymore but you.
Yeah, well, we're, you know, I'm still certainly just, you know, fascinated by it, and I think it's just important it gets reported. But, you know, I think that we've become so used to hearing these types of stories, reading about this, that in a way we're sort of desensitized to it. You know, I'm not even sure what new revelation, you know, could be made. It's really funny. Just, again, with this particular document, Scott, you know, I went through, it's 24 pages, it's attached to the story if people want to read it. I looked through it, there were certainly things I could have brought up in terms of the medical aspects of this, what they're doing, you know, with regard to the, you know, the force feeding and the hunger strike, but I've reported that so many times. What really stood out, honestly, was the fact that they renamed this a long-term non-religious fast,
right.
You know, and that hunger strike doesn't appear in a hunger strike standard operating procedure. It does not. It's not there at all.
Right.
And so, to me, that was just, you know.
I mean, you're right. In a way, the fact that they would resort to this euphemism is the most newsworthy part of it. Not necessarily
exactly.
The most important part of it, but the most newsworthy part is that. And it's outrageous. It is almost as outrageous as what it is that they're doing. That they're going to go ahead and just lie in the name of the damn thing. You know?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, so. So, you know, it was, I knew that, like, well, if I were to focus on that, I think that will get, you know, the attention of people.
And by the way, has it gotten any kind of TV attention or anything like that?
It hasn't. And I'm not surprised at that. You know, I think that...
it's catchy, though. You know, it could.
Yeah.
It's
true. You know, it's just the military never ceases to amaze.
No, see, here's NBCNews.com picked you up right here 3 hours ago.
I'm sorry?
NBCNews.com is running one. It says here on Google 3 hours ago, they credit the Miami Herald.
Oh, yes, yes. That's a little point of contention there that I have with that particular report, which failed to provide proper credit, as they often do, when I obtained these documents via FOIA.
Well, that's too bad. Well, it must be Carol Rosenberg, but did she give you credit at least?
No, and that's part of the problem. Very typical, happens often. I've become used to it.
Yeah, well, you know what? What matters the most is that you're doing the work, and I know you feel that way about it in the first place, and that's why you do such good work. Otherwise, you'd be just reporting on football games and making a lot of money.
Exactly.
So.
Well, thanks, Scott.
Comes down to it. If what it takes is taking your name off it to get NBC to look at it, then damn it. I'm sorry, Jason, but I guess we're just going to have to carry on. That is too bad, though, about Carol Rosenberg. I'm sorry to hear that she would do you that way. But,
there's as I indicated, I've got this FOIA lawsuit. There'll be plenty of more documents hopefully coming soon. So, you know, I do feel confident that we'll be able to continue to, put out some news about Guantanamo. And I appreciate you taking the time to cover it, Scott.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, as always, Jason. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'll speak to you soon.
All right. That's Jason Leopold, everybody, at Vice.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, like I was saying, yats. America's pet prime minister of the new Ukrainian post-coup d'etat government was in the White House, was in the Oval Office just a moment ago. I guess they probably ushered his ass out by now. But anyway, point being, Obama has said, one, he wants Congress to hurry up and pass giant welfare payments to Ukraine. In other words, he wants the Federal Reserve to print money and buy American bonds at your expense, in order to send some money to prop up the new post-coup d'etat government over there with lots of strings attached to the future of the people of that country, east and west there. And also he says that America absolutely, well, I should be careful, CNN claims that Obama says, which sounded reasonable enough, but we should never take CNN's word for anything, really. They claim that what he said was the United States absolutely rejects the upcoming referendum this Sunday in Crimea. Absolutely rejects it, huh? Or what? You ought to listen to his ex-Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, saying the Crimea's lost, get over it. Crimea never belonged to America. Belonged it? Is that what I just said? Nice talking, dude. It never did belong to it in the first place over there, man. It's too far away. It couldn't possibly belong to the North Americans. It does not belong to the North Americans. It did belong to the Russians, and now it belongs to them again. You know what? Hey, that sucks for the people who live on Crimea who don't want to be ruled by the Russian government. Sucks really bad for them. And that includes all the Muslim minority types who presumably favor an independent Ukraine compared to living under the Russian domination, although I don't really know that. And it goes for, each and every individual in Crimea who doesn't want to live under Russian authority. But apparently, the majority does. And according to American rules, the majority rules. And so, it's their majority, not the majority. What will the majority of Americans let our government get away with? But what will the majority of their people let their government get away with? And in this case, of course, there is, you know, in all cases, there, I-E-I-R, yeah, depends a lot on who you're asking. In this case, it's the Crimeans. It's not the Ukrainians who decide, not East, not West, not all of them. It's going to be the Crimeans. And the die's already cast. And since it's already too late, what in the hell is Obama talking about? Why did he wait so long to bring Yats to the White House and say, in effect, this will not stand, when it's already a fait accompli? Are they just trying to brag about the fact that, yeah, this is our sock puppet that we put in there? The former head of their central bank. Loyal employee of the American Empire.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawney Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay, good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him? Is the next step.
Anyway, so that's where they go. Yeah, what we need to do. F the EU, they're taking too long. We're going to have Ban Ki-moon is sending his sock puppet over there, and I'm going to have Joe Biden call, and we're going to midwife this thing, and we're going to glue it together, and we're going to make it all work, and then lo and behold, coup d'etat, and Yats is in charge, huh? Just in case there was any question as to who put Yats in charge, it wasn't the people of Ukraine. It was the American Empire. And now they want to cry they lost Crimea. They never belonged to them in the first place. Amazing. Well, anyway, isn't it funny how, and you can tell this too, can't you? That the entire premise of the American foreign policy in this instance is that Putin's a reasonable guy. He's not going to do anything unless we push it way too far, you know? We got room to play around. He's a cool customer, man. He's not gonna, you know, do anything really crazy. I mean, that may not be correct, although I tend to think it probably is. But doesn't that seem to be the premise of the war party's entire argument here? I mean, they didn't think he'd go as far as move troops into Crimea. But they seem to be taking for granted the fact that he is absolutely not what they say he is. Some kind of, you know, radical rightist, Ronchevist, who wants to reconquer the former Soviet Empire. That's not what's going on here. His so-called Eurasian Union, which he can't seem to even really put together very well, is a NAFTA agreement. It ain't a USSR Warsaw Pact or anything of the sort. And they kind of take it for granted that, you know, yeah, okay, I'll take Ukraine or whatever. It's not like he's going to really push back hard. After all, when the Americans did a coup d'etat against Yanukovych back in 2004 and replaced him with Yushchenko and Timoshenko, the gas princess, all the Russians had to do was wait till the next election. Then they won again. And Yanukovych got in charge. Now the Americans have overthrown him again. The Russians have upped the ante a little bit by taking Crimea, but obviously they could just wait until the next election. Although, let's see. I guess it depends. As Rand Paul was pointing out, I hate to give him credit for getting anything right at all. This is one of the first times I ever heard him say anything smart. Was that, you know, if the Russians run off with Crimea, they're taking all those pro-Russian voters out of the Ukrainian election rolls. And maybe, you know, the Westerners will have the upper hand in the future of the democracy there in Ukraine. That's something that Putin needs to think about. But anyway, the way they would have you think, oh, this Putin, he's Osama bin Laden, he's a bad guy, he's our enemy. Everybody yell and throw your shoes at the telescreen. You know, he's a government says hate him for at least 2 minutes. Once every workday. Make sure that you are immune from hearing any reasonable arguments from him or anyone who's explaining what he might be thinking. But meanwhile, they take for granted that he's all right. Oh, Putin, yeah, he ain't gonna do it. It'd be all right. And put some sanctions on him and whatever a little bit. But. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I think the Americans could really screw this up. I think, for example, if they push this too hard, then Putin might decide that he wants to let all pressure off of Iran. You know, to whatever degree he's helping the Americans glue this thing, the Iran nuclear deal, together, he could call that off. He could step up his support for the Assad dictatorship and help them win outright over the rebels, so-called rebels, the Mujahideen that America and Saudi are supporting in Syria right now. He could, I don't know, he could do a lot of things. He could close down the bases that are being used by the Americans in the stands, or he at least has a lot of influence there, in the entire, Central Asian supply route into Afghanistan. Not to mention cause all kinds of trouble in Afghanistan if he wants, supporting this or that faction or this or that warlord. So, you know, ever since 9/11, Vladimir Putin's really been a friend of American policy, even if the Americans haven't, really wanted to be friends with him back. He's insistent on maintaining independence for Russia from the American empire. But when Bush said, "Help me invade Afghanistan," he said, "Sure." And he was under a lot of pressure inside Russia by their military hardliners to not do so. And he said, "George Bush, anything I can do to help you invade Al-Qaeda." Now, you might say he was sneaky, and like Bin Laden, he was just trying to bleed our empire dry. That might be right. But at least to our face, he was being friendly and cooperative. And he certainly saved Obama from talking himself into a war last summer. Saved us from Obama talking himself into a war last summer in Syria. And again, he's at least cooperating with the nuclear deal and getting this nuclear deal with Iran signed right now, when he could use that, he could sabotage that if he wanted, I guess, and try to, you know, keep that as a thorn in the empire's side in the Middle East instead of resolving the Iran issue. And all for what? When even under Ukrainian authority, the Black Sea Fleet is going to stay in Crimea. I mean, they really think that they're going to be able to get the Crimean Peninsula and that base away from the Russians? Come on. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, on the Iran issue, by the way, you may have noticed Benjamin Netanyahu tried to make a big deal about how they seized a ship somewhere off the coast of Sudan that he swears is an Iranian boat on its way to the Gaza Strip to arm Hamas with some artillery. Well, he didn't prove it. He just said so. And at least some of the mainstream reporting that I read, including in Haaretz, had it that everybody, you know, all the major media outlets and whatever, they didn't even really try to follow it up and prove it because they didn't really believe it. Everybody just kind of reported, well, this is what Netanyahu said. And, you know, it may well be Iran has supported Hamas for a long time. But then again, it was the Israelis that insisted on holding the elections of 2005 and 6 there in, I guess it was 05 and 06 was when it really took effect, right? What was it, 06? I guess it was 06. Anyway, it was the Israelis and the Bush administration that insisted on holding those elections and, in fact, tying up all of Fatah's money, the PLO's money, so they couldn't buy all their votes, and basically ensured, if accidentally, perhaps not accidentally, that Hamas won. And now, so Hamas is the democratically elected government of really all of Palestine, even though they have no authority whatsoever in the West Bank or East Jerusalem. But in Gaza, they're the democratically elected, which is magic fairy pixie dust, as everyone knows. That is the test of legitimacy. Oh, no. The Americans don't like them because the Israelis don't want the Americans to like them. And so, no, it doesn't matter whether they're elected or not, just like in Ukraine, just like in Egypt. Just like in Algeria, just like in Lebanon, when Hezbollah does well at the polls in Lebanon. Nothing legitimate about that. But anyway, they say, look, everybody, artillery. Perhaps the Iranians were arming up Hezbollah with some artillery. Well, I guess I got to give him credit. He succeeded in distracting me on this show for about a minute and a half already. But my only point is, what a stupid, ridiculous distraction. And isn't it transparent? And isn't it easy to keep your eye on the ball whenever Netanyahu cries Iran? The issue is the occupation in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and in East Jerusalem, where the people of Palestine have been conquered and live as helots and have for 50 years there, since the 1967 war. Now, I'm not saying I'm in favor of all of the ethnic cleansing that took place, to establish the 1948 borders. Those refugees still live in refugee camps, you know, across the Middle East. In Jordan and Syria, I guess, especially. But at least it makes sense to have, over a long term, an Israeli state, a stable Israeli state, when their number one requirement is that they maintain this heavy Jewish majority, and they have one. What doesn't make sense at all is the status quo in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. It's horrible what's going on there. And now I'm not saying what they should do is force march everybody out of there. What they should do is relinquish their control. It's true that they conquered that land, but under post-World War II rules, not allowed to take land from your sovereign state neighbors anymore. We'll have negotiations. Aggressive war is illegal. And moving your civilian population into conquered territory now is illegal ever since Hitler tried to do it with his whole Lebensraum, or whatever, however you pronounce it. Is there a B? It's just the one B. Anyway, all that breathing room. Yes, we want to expand the size of our state. Post-World War II, UN Charter rules. You can't do that. And so what the Israelis have tried to do is just sort of half-ass it. They relatively slowly, increase the amount of civilian Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And they just, treat all the Palestinians who live there like they're invisible. Cut them off from their property, cut them off from their families, built giant walls right in the middle of communities, and, basically do whatever they want with them. And no one on earth can stop them because the Americans have their back. And the American government has their back for a lot of reasons, but one of the main ones is because the American people don't have the slightest idea what's going on over there. And, I guess I'm being repetitive from over the weekend when I explained this to others, but I guess it's the best way I know to say it. And I could be wrong about this. You could think I'm an idiot for thinking this, but I think that what most Americans think about what's going on in Palestine is what my understanding was when I was a teenager and didn't understand anything about it, other than, wow, that sounds like a really big, complicated topic that I don't know the first thing about that maybe I'll learn about someday, right? Back then, back before I actually decided to try to learn something about it, what was it? I was under the impression that there was something like, vaguely, a country of Palestine. And those damn terrorists just kept suicide bombing the poor Israelis. And even some Israelis think they should negotiate with the terrorists and give up some land to them so that they'll stop attacking them. But the others say that doesn't make any sense to go ahead and give in to terrorists and give up land, let them hold you hostage and suicide bomb you unless you give them land. You should fight back and defeat them. And that was the extent. I wasn't even taking sides. That was just the extent of all sides of the argument as far as it was ever portrayed in media. And that's not how I learned it from my family, really. We never really talked about Palestine. I didn't really learn anything about it from them. This is just kind of my TV understanding, my radio understanding of the situation over there. Land for peace. It's a sellout, I tell you. Well, no, I think we should do it. No, it's a sellout. That's it. But no one ever said, it's not your land. Palestine isn't the country next door. Palestine is the occupied territory. Where, remember when the Americans occupied Iraq and fought that war for 8 years, that kind of thing? Well, it's been like that in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. That kind of occupation by a foreign power of people who look different, believe different, speak different. And their military occupying these people in that exact same Iraq war occupation fashion for 50 years. So when people say, you know, a big part of America's terrorist problem is that we support Israel, they're not saying we support Israel, those nice guys who are hated just because of their freedom. And so we owe it to them to help defend them from these horrible terrorists who won't leave them alone. No, it's our support for what Israel is doing wrong in the world, what they are doing wrong to people. In attempting to colonize and steal the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Well, I guess they don't even want Gaza anymore. Too much trouble for what it's worth. But they call the West Bank Judea and Samaria. And they're not giving it up. Not unless the American government makes them give it up. And the American government won't make them give it up, despite what all you hear about it. But the truth is that every other political government on the planet basically is against this thing, including most of Europe. And it makes no sense. And it does. If you take an American national interest point of view, it makes no sense whatsoever that we ought to have to suffer 9/11 attacks occasionally because of our support for Israel's permanent, indefinite occupation of the Palestinians. It's madness. Nobody would support that except for Eric Alterman, who famously said, and he was being honest. He was saying, we should be honest and stop pretending that America's interests and Israel's interests are exactly the same. They're not. In fact, our support for Israel and their occupation helped even to cause the 9/11 attacks, he said. And then he said, which is fine with me. Really, Eric Alterman from The Nation magazine, a prominent, you know, Hillary Clintonian, center-left, liberal, intellectual writer, said, that's fine with me. But we should be honest about it. He's fine with 3,000 other Americans dying for American support for Israel. And again, not for Israel's very existence, not for Israel minding their own business and being a nice guy, but for Israel's permanent degradation, occupation, mass theft and mass murder of the people of Palestine. You know, what's going to happen eventually, and in pretty short order, I guess, as Jimmy Carter, our former president, obvious liberal dove type, nowadays anyway, is that they will end up in a real de facto apartheid state, really already is. But there will come a point where it's no longer considered an occupation, where the West Bank and East Jerusalem, at least, are considered just outright part of Israel, because you just can't deny it anymore. They have annexed it. And then at that point, and especially, I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but certainly in the near future, because of the birth rates, the Arabs, Christians and Muslims will outnumber the Israeli Jews. And then at that point, it will be a minority apartheid dictatorship like South Africa. It already is de facto in a lot of ways, depending on exactly how you categorize it. But, you know, in other words, Netanyahu and his partisans here in the United States, they are the worst enemies. Their entire right-wing Likud coalition, they are ultimately the worst enemies of the future of the Israeli state. They're blowing it up from the inside. They're committing suicide with their, they're like mini me Americans over there, really. Over there reaching for too much empire, biting off more than they can chew, and destroying themselves with their ridiculous and short-sighted policies. And so, what's going to happen, because eventually even the Americans won't be able to support them anymore when it's, you know, an outright apartheid minority rule dictatorship in the coming years. And in fact, that's what Ehud Olmert, who's, I believe, still currently the defense minister of Israel, has said. Their former prime minister from the Clinton years, who is currently their secretary of defense, basically, has said that very same thing. And yet, he's the one getting it done. Hey, all Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes, and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office, and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Express. And I'm joined on the phone by the boss of the Liberty Express, Alan Butler from Butler on Business, and the man that makes the whole thing go. Welcome to the show, Alan. How you doing?
I'm all right. Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today.
I'm always glad to be on with my buddy.
All right, well, good times. By the way, everybody, I forgot to mention, go and check at The Intercept. That's, what the hell is it? Well, you know, Greenwald's thing, The Intercept. Just Google it. Firstlook.com/The Intercept. That's it, or .org. Also, The New York Times today as well, a Charlie Savage, Laura Poitras piece. Both of them, huge, explosive stories based on Snowden documents. One of them is about the history of the FISA court and how it evolved to get so far out of control. And then the other is this NSA thing where their bots can hijack millions of computers with all this malware and this and that that Greenwald and Gallagher have written about at The Intercept. So go and look at that stuff. Okay, now to the interview. Adam, cut that part out. Now to the interview, Alan Butler from Butler on Business. Now, here's one of the cool things about Alan. There's lots of cool things about Alan, but one of the cool things about Alan is he knows this guy who used to work at, I believe it's the Federal Reserve at the Treasury.
I know people that work at both, but I think what we're getting ready to discuss is the jobs report.
Right, yeah, you had one of these guys who was the guy who wrote these horrible bogus statistics, but then he taught you how to decode them, right? Who's that?
Well, the fellow's name is Keith Hall, Scott, and he ran the Bureau of Labor Statistics for 5 years. They're appointed to 5-year terms. They're designed to straddle administration, so 3 years under Bush 43, 2 years under the Obaminator.
Mm-hmm. And now, it's funny because, you know, for somebody like me, I don't really have any money, so I don't pay too much attention to all the investment stuff and whatever, but, or, you know, watch the financial channels that much or that kind of thing. But I do, from time to time, I pick up on the fact that they're always coming up with new formulas to define their statistics, and it's always, in a way, and obviously so, unabashedly so, in a way to disguise the pain of regular people. So when it comes to the inflation rate, they say, oh, well, if you had to switch from, you know, sliced roast beef to bologna, then that doesn't, because the price of roast beef went up so high, then that doesn't mean that there's been any inflation there because you still have bologna to eat. So we can count that, you know, you might have counted a point up, but we get to count that point back off again as long as you have bologna. And I know that they do the same thing with all of the rates. And yet what's funny to me, I swear I'm going somewhere with this. What's funny to me is this. The way I look at it, we're already living in the future here in 2014. So they must have redefined the unemployment rate so many times now, structural this and whatever kind of jargon that, where it doesn't even mean a thing compared to the real reality of who's actually needing work and who's able to get it. Am I right about that?
Well, Yes, but, you know, I want to first of all defend the career people that work for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They do a good job compiling the data, but it is our Congress that dictates how the data are presented. So you can, if somebody is interested in looking through the tables that are generated each month by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you can cut through the smoke that's perpetrated by the media and the politicians and figure out exactly what happened in any particular month.
All right, but now wait, let me ask you this. Are you swimming right now?
No, I'm not.
Okay, because you sound like you're in the deep end of a pool.
Well, we have to thank, Tim Cook now with Apple. I'm on my iPhone 5.
All right, well, you sound better now, so please go ahead.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that headline number everybody hears at the beginning of each, on the first Friday of every month. That number gets presented by the media and the politicians as being the number of jobs that were added every month. But in reality, that number, that headline number, actually reflects the difference between what happened and what they thought was going to happen. It's not the number of jobs that have been added or lost in a particular month. It's basically the variance. And I'll give you an example. If you recall January, they said we added, I think it was about 133,000 jobs in January. But Scott, we lost over 2,800,000 jobs in January, about 113,000.
Is it really as simple as that? The way they lie, they just neglect to mention how many were lost, and they only just talk the gross incoming, and that's it. They just never tell you the net job numbers.
Well, it's the reporters that don't tell you. The data are clearly in the report. I mean, if you want to sit there and look at the report, you can see what actually took place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say there's months, though, like February, where what gets reported, in the case of February, we were told that it was 175,000 jobs added, but in February, we actually added 750,000 jobs. But the 175,000 was that many more than the 500,000 they thought we were going to add. But I can tell you for the year, we're still down, I think it's 2,082,000 jobs for the 2 months ended February 28th. We're behind the rate of job creation, if you can call a negative number a creation of a job. We're down about 14% on the year. Now, the real problem that I saw in the February report is of the 750,000 jobs we added in the month of February, 300,000 or 40% were private sector jobs, meaning 60% were public government jobs. So now let's take a look at the 300,000 private sector jobs we added in February. Everybody got all excited. They thought that was a big number, good number, 175,000. The real number was 300, but it wasn't a good number because that represented a 46% decline in private sector earnings, February 2014 versus February 2013. And if you look at the private sector hiring year to date, we're down substantially, 13.5% year to date, 2 months ending February 28th. If you look at the last 3 months, we lost a quarter of a million jobs roughly in December. We lost 2,800,000 in some change in January. And then we added 750 back in February. So, Scott, we're still down over 2,100,000 jobs since December 1st. Now, I think any way you slice it, that is not a good number. Now, the other thing, too, is the media represents a figure called the U3, and they act like that is the unemployment rate. And for the month of February, they are telling us that we have a 6.7% quote-unquote unemployment rate, but that 6.7% really represents only the short-term unemployed. Now, to be counted in that number, you have to meet three conditions. First of all, you had to have a job to begin with. Then you had to lose the job, and you had to lose it within the last 26 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and then you had to go out on a job interview in the last 4 weeks. So if you're a kid graduating from college and you don't have a job yet, you're not counted in that 6.7% number. If you lost your job 26 27 weeks ago, you're not counted in that 6.7% number. If you haven't been out on a job interview in the last 4 weeks, you're not counted there either.
You know what? Let me ask you this. What's the excuse for that? Because that just, you know, I've always heard that, and I know it's been like that for a long time. If you go so long without being able to get a job, they stop counting you. But it seems to me the only answer to why is because they don't like the number looking too high, because that makes them look bad, and they're the politicians, and so they're the ones in charge of what number's being reported. But among economists, even Democrat economists or whoever, do they have a justification? What is the devil's advocate position for stopping counting people who could be working except for that they can't find any work, even if that means they gave up and quit trying? That would, wouldn't you assume that that's a rational decision that they made to give up because there ain't a damn job to go get?
Well, in some cases, it's worse than that. In this country, most of the job searching now is done on the Internet, and that doesn't count as looking for a job. Now, in Europe, it does.
So you could even still be looking for a job, and they don't even count that. Well, so, okay, but so what's the devil's advocate position for that? What's their excuse for that, Alan?
Scott, in the case of the U3, it's really not designed to tell us the number, total number of unemployed people. It's designed to tell us people that represent that group that I just mentioned. But let me give you an example of why the U3, the media, and the politicians are who get fixated on that U3 number, that 6.7%. Do you remember the 99-week people getting unemployment benefits for 99 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
You realize that they continued to collect 73 weeks worth of unemployment checks longer than they were being counted as unemployed? In other words, they got unemployment checks.
Right.
We quit counting them in the U3 in 26 weeks, but sent them unemployment checks for 73 weeks thereafter.
Right.
And
it's almost like they assume, well, you know, if you're out of work that long, then you must lay down and starve to death, and we don't have to worry about you anymore after that.
Well, and then another reason why that U3 is not the number to be looking at is the average person in this country who is unemployed has been unemployed for a little over 37 weeks, which means the average unemployed person isn't even in that 6.7% number. The number that the career people look at is what we call the employment ratio. It's the percentage of the population that is currently working, and that number is steady at 58.8%. Now, when the recession got underway, it was 63%. When the recession supposedly ended, it was in the upper 59%
dial. Right.
So here we are. We have a situation where, and again, that's across the entire population. So we have 315 million people in this country times 5%. You're looking at close to 15 million fewer people working today than when the recession supposedly got underway.
Right. And by the way, you know, in the Bush years, that was a jobless recovery itself. That might have been real good times if you were an investor in Countrywide for a little while or something like that. But there are a lot of regular people who are still hurting and wondering what recovery, even in the height of that bubble. And now we're living after the collapse of the bubble. Of course, they say we're in a jobless recovery right now. They say we're in a bubble right now. If this is the good times before the next crash, then I don't know what the hell's going to happen, but it sounds like it's probably going to hurt pretty bad when we get to the bottom.
Well, if you stop and think, if it was a jobless recovery, we'll talk about this on the other side of the break.
Yeah, we're stuck. All right, there's the bumper music. It's Alan Butler. He's the host of Butler on Business here on the Liberty Express, and we'll be back on the other side of this here thing. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. scotthorton.org is where I keep all my stuff. Interview archives and such like. Okay, I'm talking with Alan Butler, host of Butler on Business, and we're talking about the real unemployment rate, the real comparison of the numbers of those with jobs to those who could be working. In fact, do we ever get right to that? Does anybody ever work out exactly that ratio? You said they You know, you don't want to look at the one that the media people always cite. You want to look at the, what was it? It went from 63 to 58, the number of people who are employed. You know how that compares to how many people are able and willing to work if they had a chance to?
The 58-8 is called the employment ratio. That number looks at the total population of the United States. And the reason they, the career people look at that, 58.8% of the people in this country currently are working, which means 41.2% of the people are not. The 41.2% of the population that doesn't work depends on the 58.8% who do. If you want to look at future economic activity, what powers the economy, who's generating the revenue, it's the 58.8.
Well, not even all of them, because a lot of them are government employees, and they're just tax parasites, too. And also all the people that work for all the firms that suck off the taxpayer, like the bankers and the military-industrial complex and, the and hell, the food companies that service the government and all those kinds of people who really only exist on, you know, political dollars, not market ones.
Well, and that's why the February results, where 60% of the jobs that were added were government jobs, 40% were private sector, and that was a plunge of 46% compared to a year earlier.
Right.
So, you know, the real...
Is there ever a number where they say, out of the entire population of the American people, here are the number of able-bodied people who would be working if they could? Because I know they exclude everybody out as many ways as they can, it seems like.
Prior, from the inception of the Department of Labor, back in the late 1800s, the original definition of being unemployed was not working but would work if work were available. And you would agree with that is a good definition, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my question. What's that total number compared to, you say it's, you know, the number of people working out of the entire population is about 63% at the height of a Bush bubble, for example, and it's about 58% now. Well, what's the total number if we had real full employment in terms of everybody who's really looking for work?
You mean if we go back to the how many do we have unemployed right now using the classical definition, the original definition, not working but would work if work were available, it's right at 24%. Roughly one in four people are out of a job right now who would work if they could find a job.
Right. So that means we're not counting your grandma, we're not talking about your little cousin, and we're not talking about quadriplegics, and we're not talking about people who are legitimately structurally unemployed. We are talking about people who would be working, except that the Democrats and Republicans are at war against this economy, apparently.
Yeah, and that number would be 24%. Now, interestingly, they changed the definition from the one you and I both agree is the one that sounds reasonable, not working but would work if work were available, to this current definition during the FDR years and the Great Recession. And in that case, they did change it to define away a bunch of unemployed people to make the numbers look better. During the Clinton years, we have a statistic. We have a U3, which I told you was 26 weeks. The U6 goes out to 365 days. Well, during the Clinton years, they redefined the discouraged workers out of the U6, and so Clinton, with a stroke of a pen, defined away 5 million unemployed people. So there are times when the politicians or who make these decisions, their career people calculate, you know, they compile the data, they do a good job at compiling the data, but you know, when they're told by the Congress, you will report this data this way, they salute and present the data the way they're told to present it. But you can look through the tables to find the real data. You mentioned the inflation rate. You know, right now we're in a period where we're being told by the media, by the central bankers, and by the politicians that we have 1.5% inflation.
Right. Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Well, here's an interesting thing. If you look at the last 5 years where we've supposedly had 1.5% inflation, in aggregate we've had about 9% accumulatively over these last 5 years. But if you look at the index that they use for tallying food stamp benefits on a per-recipient basis, during this period where, in aggregate, we've had 9% inflation, the core things that you and I have to buy to live on have gone up 35%. And that's actually a more representative inflation rate. That's slightly under 7% over the five-year period. So there are ways to get to the real numbers, even looking at the government reports. And in this case, the food stamp inflation index is a great place to see what's really going on with the inflation rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, hey, anybody who has to eat food or, you know, drive their truck to the grocery store to get food knows that the value of the dollar has been declining lately. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. And I don't know what the numbers are, but I know they're lying when they tell me the number is 1 point something, anything. And I know that everybody knows better than that, because you don't have to be an economist or political at all to know that you're telling me it costs how much for this package of bread or meat or eggs or milk or whatever staple you name, wheat product or whatever it is. Are you kidding me? Yeah, I went and got this small couple of bags worth of stuff, cost $300. What? You know? And everybody's living that way right now. And even on TV, they admit it, and they'll admit that, well, geez, it's kind of a mystery. Because officially, the numbers are still only 1 point something, I heard. You know? That's the way they report it. Now, we're not sure what's causing so much pain, but our government assures us that you must be imagining it.
Except there is a way to get to the data. And if you look at how they're adjusting the food stamps, while they're telling us 1.5%, they're bumping up food stamp benefits by 7% because they recognize that's what food costs are doing.
Right.
But, you know, I will say again on the inflation numbers, it's also the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They go out and price check 80,000 goods every month. And you cannot argue with their data. The problem is when they generate these indices, and the politicians tell the career people, you will report this number this way. They salute and report it that way. But you can get to the data by looking at what they compile.
Well, and so, isn't it a big deal that you would have that much inflation in a time where there's, you know, during the Bush years, there were such bad, I mean, they write trillions of dollars worth of bad bets and bad investments still had to be liquidated and deflated out of the economy. That many different people who were involved in taking out loans on a regular basis as part of the operations of their business went bankrupt, quit doing so. That, you know, multiplication factor, the fractional reserve ratio, you know, kind of petered out and to a great degree, to a worldwide degree, right? I've seen the pictures of the sea of ghost shipping ships off the coast of Singapore, you know, like hundreds of massive container ships that are just sitting there with nothing to do. A massive global deflation because of the height of the bubble had to be popped. And yet still you're telling me it's more like 7% inflation a year, price inflation a year, just because of the amount of new money that they've created. Even with all that deflationary pressure, the amount of money that they've created in order to try to fill up those holes from all those bad bets and at least make the banks whole at the rest of our expense, that they've been able to still inflate that much. And that's before the banks have loaned out all the money that the Fed gave them and that they're keeping on balance at the Federal Reserve now. And we're already at 7% price inflation on the shelves is what you're telling me.
Yes. And that is a government number. Now, it's not a well-publicized government number, but it is in those reports that are generated every month. It's just that our media and our politicians choose to ignore those points. And, it, you know, it goes back to the conversation you and Charles and I had about Victoria Nuland yesterday. The state is in their hands when they tell us that we have 6% unemployment and the numbers are, you know, 5-6 times that, but where it's likewise with the inflation report. I mean, doesn't the 7%, I mean, you can buy that one, can't you? You would agree that the way they're tallying up for people buying food, that we've had 7% inflation?
Sure seems like it in a lot of ways anyway. Well, and you know, in the Bush years, There were some prices that stayed pretty flat. Fuel and food and housing had bubbles in them and had a lot of upward pressure in them, but there were other prices that didn't really go up. It doesn't seem to me like it's real. I mean, gas has been $3, $3.50, almost $4, kind of varying in there for years and years now. It doesn't seem like there's been that much upward pressure in fuel prices lately, at least here in Texas, but I don't know how that is, everywhere else. But then again, doesn't have to be, right? The inflation is the creation of the new bank credit and the new currency by the state. The effect in certain sectors or all of them is dependent on a lot of other factors other than just the creation of new money, right? All kinds of different government policies and wishes of the marketplace and all of that have effect too. So, we certainly had huge price inflation in housing there for a while, ending in 2008. And I guess, it looks like we kind of have that again now, right? A new housing bubble?
Yeah, they're calling this one the echo bubble. But before we leave, the one thing I like to do is track that 1964 quarter.
Uh-huh.
In 1964 and earlier, we had 90% silver coins.
Right.
You could buy a gallon of gasoline in 1964 for a quarter. You'd still buy a gallon of gasoline today with a 1964 quarter. Scott, it's been a pleasure, but I got to send a show from Austin to Chicago, so I'll let you go.
Thanks, Alan. Appreciate it.
Bye.
All right, everybody. That's Alan Butler. Butler on Business here on Liberty Express tomorrow morning, and I forgot what time. Anyway, see y'all tomorrow. Thanks.